This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Just to introduce our speaker, Dr. Joe Guglielmo is a pharmacist, a clinical scientist, a teacher, and an international expert in evidence-based use of antimicrobials to treat infections. He has served as the dean of UCSF School of Pharmacy since April 2013, where he holds the Troy C. Daniels Distinguished Professorship in Pharmaceutical Sciences. He is also a professor in the Department of Clinical Pharmacy, which he chaired from 2006 until he was named the dean, and serves as the Associate Director of Pharmaceutical Services in the UCSF Medical Center. He is widely known as an advocate for therapeutic-related research, from basic sciences to health policy research. He created the Medication Outcome Center in 2007 to research and improve medication use and management in the UCSF Medical Center. In the 1980s, he established the UCSF Medical Center Antimicrobial Stewardship Program to study and improve antimicrobial use and management. He practices in the UCSF Medical Center, where he's an infectious disease pharmacist supporting the UCSF Medical Center Antimicrobial Stewardship Program and serving on the Infectious Disease Counsel Service Team, which I myself counseled. See counsel every week, pretty much. Beyond the hospital, he developed clinical pharmacy services for UCSF HIV-AIDS program, specifically for the HIV Women's Program and Men of Color program. Dr. Guglielmo is the author of more than 110 peer-reviewed papers, the majority related to anti-infective agents. He is a recipient of many, many, many teaching awards. He lectures worldwide on the safe and effective use of antimicrobials and other medications. He earned his pharmacy degree from University of Southern California and completed a pharmacy practice residency here at UCSF before joining the UCSF School of Pharmacy faculty. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Joe Guglielmo.
Thank you for the kind introduction. My topic is entitled Appropriate Antibiotic Use in a Community Setting, but I hope to accomplish three things today with the group and those who listen to this at some later time as well. And that is, number one, that you are clear what the benefit of antibiotics are, particularly for all the upper respiratory tract infections that you all have had and will have in the future. Number two, I want you to understand the harm that's associated with antibiotics when they're used, but they do not have benefit. And number three, I hope to give you some alternatives to antibiotics that might be useful in the management of various upper respiratory tract infections. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to really take advantage of respiratory tract infection as the way that I'm going to really emphasize the role or lack thereof of antibacterials in the treatment of disease states that, again, you have all had or will have. So let me take this one. Acute sinusitis, very common disease state. Here is a 60-year-old woman who complains of acute pain around her eyes. She has stuffy nose, she has nasal drainage, headache, and she's very lethargic, feels terrible. So I'm going to ask this question with a number of disease states here, but I'll ask you, what is the expected benefit of antibiotic treatment in this patient who has, no doubt about it, acute sinusitis? So what's the science behind this? Some of you may be aware there is a register known as the Cochrane Collaborative that does evidence-based analyses of virtually every disease state issue you can imagine. You know, name it, they have reviewed it, what the evidence is behind this. So they have reviewed what is the evidence for adults with clinically diagnosed sinusitis. And they took data that summarized the results of some 2,500 adults and 9 trials, and they just wanted to say, what is the utility of giving an antibiotic to someone who presents just the way that I just described in that previous patient? And what they concluded was, yeah, it helps, but you have to treat 15 patients to get one patient who will actually benefit. Now, why is that? That's the case because most sinusitis is viral. It's caused by a virus, not a bacteria. And as you know, antibacterials like amoxicillin and Cipro drugs, the drugs that you've heard of before, those are active against bacteria. They're not active against viruses. And 85% of the time, the etiology for this disease is going to not be a bacteria. It's going to be a virus. So then you hope, well, maybe there's a subgroup of patients that you can predict will benefit from the receipt of antibacterials. But in fact, they found that was not the case. They found that patients who were older, had symptoms for a longer period, reported more severe symptoms, they took longer to cure, but they were no more likely to benefit from antibiotics than other patients. So again, you'd have to treat 14 of the patients would get absolutely no benefit from antibiotics, and one just might. And here's a classic paper, and I could show you several like this, but it kind of summarizes it. Here is a double-blind, randomized controlled trial, the classic trial that you're supposed to do to prove or disprove whether an intervention actually works in any way. And what they did, they randomized these patients with no doubt about it, sinusitis. They either gave them amoxicillin, a drug that you've all heard of or know, or they gave a nasal steroid, or they gave the combination of a nasal steroid with amoxicillin, or they gave just placebo. And what do you think the results were? The results were nothing worked. If you gave amoxicillin, the proportion of patients with long-standing symptoms were just as much if they had not received amoxicillin, and the nasal steroid was no better. You would think a nasal steroid may take away inflammation. It does, but it does it more expeditiously and efficiently when you treat chronic sinusitis. I don't know if any of you have chronic sinusitis where you get recurrent sinus infection. This is a situation where nasal steroids are effective. But for the acute sinusitis, not effective. So the short answer is very marginal benefit with antibiotics. Now, how can you get a little bit better in determining when you have a virus versus when you have a bacteria? So there is an organization, the IDSA, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and they provide guidelines for a number of disease states, and those include guidelines for acute bacterial sinusitis. And these are very valuable. The clinical presentations which best identify a patient who has bacterial disease, not viral. Because if you think you have if you think you have bacteria, you may in fact benefit from antibiotics. If you have viral, you will not. Turns out, if your symptoms have been ongoing for greater than 10 days, and or if the symptoms are severe, what is severe? Their definition is your fever has to be high. It has to be over 102 degrees. You have to have very purulent, so very pussy-looking discharge from the nose, or facial pain, and this pain and this discharge has to have continued for 3 to 4 days. And the last one, something they call double sickening, where you had a sinusitis, and then you seem to get better. You go, oh, I feel much better than I did a couple days ago, and a couple days later, now you sicken again. That's called double sickening. Any of these three bullets are felt to be indications that, in fact, the sinusitis is bacterial and you should give antibacterials. Problem is, most of the time, people with sinusitis have none of this severity of symptoms, and those patients probably have viral disease and should not receive antibiotics. Let's take another disease state. Ear infections, acute otitis media, the bane of children, but adults to a certain extent as well. Here is a 1-year-old child who has been suffering from frequently interrupted sleep. She cries upon awakening. She constantly pulls at her left ear, and she has a fever of 100 degrees. Same question again as sinusitis. What is the expected benefit of antibiotic treatment in this patient? It's an interesting disease state. If you look at the history of acute otitis media, in 1932, this disease and the suppurative complications with this disease accounted for a quarter of all pediatric admissions to Bellevue Hospital in New York. A quarter of admissions were due to this entity. Today, severe acute otitis media and its complications definitely occur, but they really occur really in children who are underserved. They're living in regions with limited access to medical care, truly do not have access to the healthcare system. Now, there have probably been 200 studies on antibiotics in terms of determining whether or not it works for acute otitis media. And in fact, up until recently, people still debated what the benefit of antibiotics was for these kids and adults, frankly, with ear infections. And it was argued that the previous studies were just not well performed, mostly due to inadequate diagnostic criteria, just like I showed you for acute sinusitis, where if you know the diagnostic criteria that suggest bacterial disease, you can be more educated about the possibility of using antibiotics. Same thing here. So two studies appeared in the very prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, and I just took one of them for you to let you know, again, it's the precision of diagnosis is important here. So almost 300 kids with acute otitis media, but the key is they diagnosed this really strategically. They had a special scale that, in fact, they had clarified if a kid had a certain scale, like a 10 versus a 5 versus a 3, it predicted, in fact, outcome. Yet when you looked in the ear, you actually had to see that there was fluid there behind the tympanic membrane, so an effusion. And you had to have marked bulging of this membrane accompanied by pain, otalgia, or marked erythema of the membrane. So what did they do? So, as I said, several studies did not show benefit. In this case, they randomized these kids to get an antibiotic, amoxicillin clavulanate. So that some of you may know this as Augmentin. This drug was given or placebo, and it was given for 10 days. So did antibiotics work here? The answer is they did. Initial and sustained resolution of symptoms were significantly greater with antibiotics. And it wasn't subtle. If you looked at day 5 and day 12 of antibiotics, you can see the numbers there, where in fact, if you looked at persistence of signs of acute infection upon otoscopic examination, it was many times higher in those patients that got placebo versus those that got antibiotics. And lastly, it's anecdotal, one kid got mastoiditis, so a complication of the otitis where it involves the ear and bone, a very serious infection requiring weeks of therapy. On the other hand, it was only the kids who got the antibiotic who went on to get diarrhea, diaper rash, etc., which is, again, a very common complication with these antibiotics. So this disease state, little bit more likely that if you diagnose it correctly, that antibiotics do benefit the kids. Now, what does the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend, as well as the American Academy of Family Practice Physicians? What they recommend is if a child is less than 6 months of age, you give antibiotics. You give it whether it's a certain or an uncertain diagnosis. But then it gets a little looser with the older child. If you're talking about 6 months to 2 years, you give antibacterials for the certain diagnosis, or a kid who's really ill, but you're still not sure if it's really an acute otitis that's causing this kid to be miserable. But if it's severe, you give antibiotics there, but otherwise you use what they call the observation option for uncertain, not severe disease. What is the observation option at the bottom there? You give the child analgesics, so like ibuprofen, Motrin, or acetaminophen, Tylenol, and you give them a prescription for amoxicillin, which is the drug of choice, the antibacterial choice for this disease state, and you tell the parent, if your child is no better in 72 hours, fill this prescription. So this has turned things upside down for this disease state, and this is now 10 years old, this recommendation. And then lastly, if you're greater than 2 years of age, even a little bit looser, you give antibacterials only for severe certain diagnosis, but otherwise you use this observation option for every other potential acute otitis media. So this is a big change from what we used to do before, and it has spared many children exposure to unnecessary antibacterials. Another disease state, most of you have had this or will have it or will have it and will have it again, strep throat. That's what this is, streptococcal pharyngitis. Here is a 23-year-old male who complains of severe and sudden sore throat, no coughing, no sneezing, no other cold symptoms. He has incredible difficulty swallowing because of the severe pain. He has a fever that exceeds 101 degrees, and sure enough, when I look in his throat, there are white spots all over his throat. Same question again. What is the expected benefit of antibiotic treatment in this patient? So we'll learn several things with this disease state. What does this organization, the IDSA, recommend? It's always good, whether you're a layperson or you're a healthcare provider, you should be aware of these guidelines. They're quite valuable. It's a diagnostic issue again. Nobody should be giving antibiotics to someone with a sore throat unless they've done what they call a rapid antigen detection test. So this is a test that confirms the streptococcus, the strep, is there or it's not there. If it's not there, you shouldn't get antibiotics. If it is there, you should. And many people think you can discriminate between viruses, which again, like sinusitis, most sore throat is viral. Greater than 90% of sore throats is viral. No benefit from antibiotics. There is benefit if it turns out to be this strep, which is associated with strep throat. And the drugs that are used are quite simple. Penicillin is the drug of choice. But let me show you something you're going to hear. I'm going to talk about resistance quite a bit today. Here is the resistance associated with the organism that causes strep throat. And I will tell you, when I think of a bacteria, the many bacteria that are out there, like E. coli, which you've heard of, or Pseudomonas, or MRSA, which is out in the community as well, it's very rare that you don't also say that there is a high rate of resistance or developing resistance with a given bacteria. In this case, for the drug of choice, penicillin, there has never been a case of penicillin-resistant strep pyogenes, which is the streptococcus that causes strep throat. I cannot say that for many organisms, so it's really remarkable. Now, why do I say that and why is it important? It's important because you'd like to use a drug that is 100% likely to work against the organism and not worry about it. But you know what happens is a lot of people say the following, you know, I'm penicillin allergic. Well, are you really, is the question. Here is a very interesting abstract that appeared last year, and it tries to answer the question, when you say you have a penicillin allergy, do you really? So they took 500 patients with a medical record history of penicillin allergy, and they skin tested them. So much like you do skin testing when people have allergies, they did this with a concoction that I'm not going to talk about today. And what happened was, if you got the skin test and there was no reaction, then they challenged them with a penicillin derivative, and that's amoxicillin. They gave it orally. What did they find? Out of 500 patients who said they had a penicillin allergy, 4 had a positive reaction. Not 400, 4 out of 500 had a positive reaction with the skin challenge. And 4 had a significant reaction, which they didn't tell what it was, to the amoxicillin. So if you do the math here, 8 patients out of 500 who thought they had a penicillin allergy did not. And what happens in the healthcare system, when a patient says they cannot take a drug like penicillin, you end up using alternatives. It's an easy way out. But you pay for it, and I'll show that with the next slide. We have an organism that is everywhere. throughout the world, it's called VRE, vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. And the organism is not so important, but suffice to say, it's one that when you've seen a lot of antibacterials, this is something that ultimately is going to colonize and probably infect you. So this gets, and how do I link that with a penicillin allergy? Well, think about this. The hypothesis would be, if a patient says they have a penicillin allergy, they're probably going to be exposed to a lot of other different drugs and may be expanding, therefore, the likelihood that you would subsequently be colonized with a more resistant organism. And this study suggests, in fact, that is true. So it was retrospective, but they said, what is the association of having an infection due to this very resistant organism, VRE, and if the patient said they had a history of a penicillin allergy? And what they found was, if you took the general population, 6% of the general population said they had a penicillin allergy, but you know what? Of those patients that had VRE, 24% of them said they had a penicillin allergy. Stated differently, what was happening was because these patients said they had a penicillin allergy and probably said they had allergies to other drugs as well, as you see there, they got exposed to multiple other drugs, which again selected out a resistant organism. So this, the take home of this is you use the most narrow, bullet-like approach to treating infection, not the nuclear weapon approach, because it harms. And I'll show some other examples of that. But here's one that shows even something as simple as not clarifying whether you really have a penicillin allergy can make a difference ultimately on what bacteria colonize you down the line. Another disease state. You all have had this, acute bronchitis. A 35-year-old man complains of an initially dry, hacking cough, which after a few days became productive. Really nasty-looking stuff. Green mucus is brought up. He also complains of fatigue. He has a low-grade fever of 99.5 degrees, and his symptoms have continued for 2 weeks. I ask the question again. What is the expected benefit of antibiotic treatment in this patient? For greater than 40 years, studies have documented that antibiotics do not work for acute bronchitis. They simply do not work. There are probably 50 studies, no matter what antibiotic you're talking about, that do not show efficacy in the treatment of acute bronchitis. But doesn't stop the use of antibiotics. Mike Steinman's work back in 2003, over 10 years ago, the rate of getting antibiotics for a disease state that is known to not work, 60 to 80% of patients in the U.S. who had acute bronchitis still got antibiotics. This is not a good thing. But everybody goes, they're just antibiotics. They can't harm you. No big deal. Well, let's see. We'll talk about that. And say, are we any better today? That was 2003. How about 2014? Well, the CDC has been trying for the last 10 years to decrease antibiotic prescribing for acute bronchitis. In fact, since 2005, HEDIS, if you know what that is, Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Set, one of their measures, quality measures, is that the rate of antibiotic prescribing for acute bronchitis should be zero. That's what they recommend. So how are we doing? Not so good. Here from JAMA, literally last week, I added this. You can see this is the rate of antibiotic prescribing for acute bronchitis. And you see it goes back to the mid-1990s, almost the present time. And I would say I'm not too impressed. We have not done a very good job reducing this inappropriate use of antibiotics in this disease state. But one would say, come on, no big deal. It can't harm me. It can't really harm society anyway. Well, maybe it can, because resistance and superinfection. So what's resistance? Resistance is you have a bacteria, it sees antibiotics, and it develops resistance. What is superinfection? Superinfection is you have a bacteria, you give antibiotics, but what happens is you might kill that first bacteria, but superinfection takes place. In other words, other bacteria set up shop and cause infection after that. So that is called superinfection. So is there an association between antibiotic use and the emergence of resistance? And the answer is there sure is. We know that changes in antimicrobial use are paralleled by changes in the prevalence of resistance. We know that resistance is more common in healthcare-associated bacterial infections compared to community. When compared with controls, patients who harbor resistant organisms have seen antibiotics. They've received that. And critical care units are perhaps the worst because everybody's so close together and the antibiotic exposure is often quite intense and often inappropriate at times. And so there is little doubt there is a causal association. And one might say, well, come on, how bad is this really? Well, let me show you a remarkable study. This came out of Lancet 7 years ago. And what they wanted to do was they said, let's take a relatively benign group of drugs. They're called the macrolides. And I guarantee you half the group has received a Z-Pak, azithromycin. I think it's the most commonly prescribed antibiotic next to amoxicillin in the United States. Why? Because you can take it for just a few days. It stays in your blood and your body for a long time, and so you can treat, in quote, the infections. But they said, you know what? You know, when you take an antibacterial, it doesn't only go where the infection is, it goes everywhere. And what is the impact of taking this azithromycin for 3 days on carriage of organisms that are good for you? I don't know if you know this. Are you familiar with the term microbiome? Microbiome, what it means is we all have bacteria in our guts, in our lungs, on our skin, that there's little doubt we have no idea how important they are. We know today, and I'll show some evidence in a little bit, that in all likelihood, these whatever bacteria you have in your gut protects you from cancer, protects you from inflammatory bowel disease, has all kinds of impact. In fact, the number of bacterial cells you have in your body dwarf the number of cells you have here, skin, eyes, hair, whatever. You have logarithmically more bacterial cells, and we are now realizing this is a huge, huge player in how it impacts our health. So what did they do in this study? They want to know, do we alter resistance of these good bacteria? So they gave one of two, azithromycin, clarithromycin, a couple of these drugs, or placebo, and they wanted to see what was the proportion of resistance that then took place with your good flora that was in your mouth. And so what did they find? It was stunning. If you look at the top here, the two top curves here represent azithromycin and clarithromycin. This is azithromycin, this is clarithromycin. And you can see this is the proportion of macrolide-resistant pathogens. So it was at 30% at baseline, and it went up to 80% with both drugs. But here's the stunning thing. This continued out for 6 months, 180 days. The impact of that three-day course of antibiotics persisted. There was still significantly more macrolide-resistant flora at that time. So we might argue maybe nobody got harmed, but it's rather stunning that, in fact, something like that happens. And we forget this, that, in fact, there are things that happen that maybe we have yet to determine what the real harm is. So reiterating my point, if you give antibiotics, bad things can happen. There is an organism called Clostridium difficile, which is perhaps our most difficult super infector, both community and in the hospital. It is something that's isolated in the colon primarily, and it causes a diarrhea that can be lethal if not treated appropriately. And what this study shows from the New England Journal as well is that you can see the odds ratio, which means the likelihood you will get this organism is exponentially increased if you've gotten antibiotics. So, for example, the first one, a cephalosporin, that is a beta-lactam-like drug, which is like penicillin. If you receive that, the odds ratio are 3.8. That means you have a 3.8 times likelihood, so 380% likelihood that you will get Clostridium difficile compared to if you had not received this drug, and so on. So there's no doubt antecedent antibiotic use is associated with Clostridium difficile, the ultimate super infector. What about resistant bacteria? Pseudomonas aeruginosa, arguably our most difficult bacterial pathogen in a medical center. You can see at the bottom there, the longer you're on antibiotics, the more likelihood you're going to get a resistant Pseudomonas. So why don't we do better at this? I mean, so if we know there's no doubt that bacteria have these outcomes, why don't we do better? Well, prescribers do not believe their prescribing of that one prescription that one day will really be linked to resistance or toxicity or cost. And frankly, patients deserve some blame here as well. Patients do not believe that their demands for antibiotics are linked to resistance. And lastly, the cause and effect, if you want to be extremely scientific, it's very hard to prove every single time that it was the antibiotic use that resulted in the resistant pathogen. So linking changes in use with resistance is logistically difficult. So all these are barriers to appropriate antimicrobials. And then there's the bottom line. Physicians are not consistently reimbursed for oversight of programs associated with appropriate use of antibiotics. And frankly, budgetary maintenance in hospitals anyway can be a disincentive for pharmacy departments to engage in improved use of antimicrobials, particularly if the use of antimicrobials are more expensive than those that are perhaps less expensive. So there are a number of real barriers. The CDC even has a 12-step program to prevent antimicrobial resistance. First of all, they say prevent infection. When we say that, how would you do that? Vaccinate and remove catheters. So why, how does that happen? If you get vaccinated for the flu, influenza, you are far less likely to ultimately then subsequently get a bacterial infection superimposed on your flu and require an antibiotics. If you got that vaccination, you're not going to get infected. Catheters. This would be urinary catheters, so bladder catheters, or it could be intravenous catheters. We at times are sloppy. The quicker you can get those out of the body, the better, because they are a vehicle for, in fact, infection. Second principle, diagnose and treat infection effectively. So you target the likely pathogen. Don't use an antibiotic coverage that does not target the likely pathogen. And lastly, access the experts. And by that, they recommend infectious disease-trained physicians and infectious disease-trained pharmacists. They say use your antimicrobials wisely. Practice antimicrobial control. We have a stewardship program here. I think it has room for improvement. Always should. We always can get better. Use local data. Know what the resistance pattern's on. Treat infection, not contamination. You know, it's very common when a blood culture is drawn in a patient that's infected in the hospital. It's very simple. You inject a needle through the skin, into the vein, and then draw blood in someone who you think's infected. Well, the problem is if you do that sloppily, we all have bacteria on our skin. And when a bacteria grows out, that's not an infecting pathogen. In fact, it's a contaminant. It shouldn't even been there, but they didn't draw the blood culture very well. They didn't wash their hands well enough or touch the needle, or maybe the tech who tried to see what was growing out in the lab was not careful. So you don't want to treat contamination. And on and on, it goes on to, in fact, 12 steps, and I'm not going to go through all of those. But so what? Does it matter if you get infected with a resistant pathogen? And I guess the question is there any harm? Well, turns out, yes, there is. Let's just say if you don't want to stay in the hospital longer, if you don't want to cost the healthcare system or yourself if you're paying out of pocket, in fact, these three bullets repeat for Staphylococcus aureus. This is MRSA. You read about this in the news all the time. If you have MRSA, which is the more resistant of the Staph aureus, you are much more likely to have a prolongation of length of stay if you had a less resistant organism. And the same is true for bacteremia, which means the organism is growing out of your bloodstream. And the same is true if you have what's called ventilator-associated pneumonia, which means a pneumonia associated with having to have a breathing tube into your lungs. All these If you have the resistant organism, you increase costs and length of stay. And the same is true for other bacteria. Fluoroquinolones are represented by the drug Cipro, which is the one we all heard about when we had the anthrax scare, very commonly used. Turns out that patients that have seen these drugs get resistant gram-negatives like Pseudomonas, and sure enough, they are also associated with increased cost, increased length of stay. So it's a problem. The healthcare system does poorly when it has to treat more resistant bacteria. Well, what about superinfection? I told you what that means. You treated correctly, maybe, but then something else grew out, and the one thing you don't want to see grow out is this, Clostridium difficile, which I mentioned earlier. Well, is that associated with increased costs and length of stay? And sure enough, it is. In fact, if you get this in the hospital or in the community, it is associated with about twice as long length of stay and approximately a doubling of cost. And you know what? I don't know if you're familiar. The Medicare has kind of tightened down as of October 2008 in the U.S. Medicare will not pay for conditions that result from preventable errors. And they say, quote unquote, the hospital cannot bill the beneficiary for any charges associated with the hospital-acquired complication. And private insurers are adopting these mandates as well. So what are some of these non-reimbursable conditions? They include catheter-associated urinary tract infection. In other words, a bladder catheter is in place. Medicare is saying if that patient goes on and gets a bladder infection because you left a catheter in and didn't get it out as fast as you can, we are not paying you for that. That is your problem, healthcare system. They say the same thing. If they get an intravenous catheter, so this would be an IV line associated infection, they say, same thing. You caused that. That was not part of what we should be treating. It was something caused by your healthcare system and not the patient's, you know, disease state. And there are a bunch of others listed as well that I won't go into. But the next slide is what I want to show you, what they can't quite confirm. But they're saying if you have any of these three things, they would like these to be not reimbursable too. So the bottom, the one at the bottom there, Clostridium difficile associated diarrhea, they're saying that wasn't our problem. You gave antibiotics, and those antibiotics were not even necessary in your patient, and your patient went on to get Clostridium difficile. That is on your dime. You need to pay for that, not us. So this is really important stuff. Okay, so now back to the outpatient setting. What things can you do? How to intervene to make the world a little better? So let's take our disease state that, in fact, we know antibiotics do not work. That was acute bronchitis. Well, my colleague Ralph Gonzalez, who's here now at UCSF when he was in Colorado, he wanted to see if he could change the way people prescribed antibiotics for this disease state, one that antibiotics do not work. He looked at some 2,500 adult patients at baseline and about 2,000 in intervention. And what were the interventions? The full intervention was they put household and office-based patient educational materials and clinician education. They put them all over the place, and they made sure that both the patients and the providers got this. And they did something that's called practice profiling. What does that mean? It means that they keep track how often you prescribe antibiotics, and they compare you to your colleagues. And nobody likes to look bad when you're compared to your colleagues. And they go, oh, look at physician A, you are prescribing twice as often as all the others are. This was incredibly effective, as you'll see. They also did what's called academic detailing, where they had actually pharmacists going around making sure that physicians knew that this was a bad practice, giving antibiotics for bronchitis. They also had a limited intervention, which all they did was they left some office-based educational material. So what did they find out? In the full intervention site where they did everything, there was a dramatic reduction in prescription rates from about three-quarters of patients to down to about half of patients. The limited intervention site had no effect, and the control had no effect. Essentially, he determined a way that, in fact, you could improve on the treatment of acute bronchitis. Well, not too long after that, we did a study like this. We looked at, again, same disease state. We said, can we make a difference? And we looked at all patients treated for acute bronchitis over a time period, and we looked initially, did they get antibiotics for this disease state? And then our intervention was patients and physicians were provided CDC literature saying, don't take antibiotics for acute bronchitis. We gave them cough and cold packs, so free goodies. They like that. We gave newsletters saying that you shouldn't give antibiotics for acute bronchitis, and in fact, they're inappropriate to be used. So what did we find out? What did we do? Then, after we did the intervention, we took a year later, we looked at all patients treated for acute bronchitis to see if we were effective. What was the rate of receipt of antibiotics? We had a separate geographic site that we did not touch. It was our control. We go, how did we do? The answer is, not so well. It may have been statistically significant in the pre-time period. About half patients got antibacterials, which ironically is what my colleague Ralph Gonzalez got down to. Recall, he went from 74 to 48%. That was where we started. And it might have been statistically significant, but we only dropped 10% to 38%. And but the control site, there was no change at all. So clinically significant, yes. Clinically meaningful, I think not. I was hoping for a lot better outcome. What's kind of interesting, the second bullet, there is this patient-seeking, antibiotic-seeking behavior, and more patients who initially got antibiotics came back and got a second prescription. They were much more likely compared to those that did not get a prescription for antibiotics, which kind of brings me to a very interesting Sir William Osler quote, and that is, the desire to ingest medicines is one of the principal features which distinguish man from the animals. Okay, so let me, a fantastic case report that is a bit stunning, and this came from JAMA Internal Medicine last week. It was called Balancing the Benefits and Risks of Empirical Antibiotics for Sinusitis. They say a teachable moment. A 70-year-old male diagnosed with acute sinusitis, a disease state that I told you, you better make sure it's bacterial, not viral, because they don't work for viral. But he was treated with antibiotic. 2 days later, he developed diarrhea. 2 days. And he discontinued the antibiotic. His physician prescribed Lamotil, so something that several people have used for the severe diarrhea. But then what happened? 5 days after the initial visit, he presented to the emergency room pale, had a very low blood pressure. He reported an uncountable number of episodes of diarrhea. Sure enough, he was diagnosed with Clostridium difficile. It was incredibly toxic to the point that he destroyed his colon, and he had to undergo a small bowel resection and near total removal of his large bowel. Despite multiple surgical procedures, mechanical ventilation, full support, he died. He died, and it had all started with a prescription for an antibiotic that he did not need. So there's back to this microbiome issue. Here's kind of an interesting thing. Here's a, you know, antibiotics predispose patients to eczema. This is a meta-analysis, so it means looking at many trials together of young children and adults. And what they found was, it says pooled OR, the 1.41, that means there was a 41% increased likelihood that that child would ultimately get eczema because they had an antibiotic. And furthermore, there was a 7% increase in eczema for each additional antibiotic course received during the first year of life. Okay, well, give you another one. Here are infants who, in fact, got antibacterials when they were very young. And it turns out a significantly increased number of babies who then went on to become adolescents ended up getting inflammatory bowel disease. I get back to this microbiome issue, things we don't yet know that now are being revealed. And if this isn't good enough, antibiotics make you fat. Now, this might be good in some places, and it may be bad in others. Here is one of the great Avon studies, and this is looking at 11,000 children born in this area, and they found that antibiotic exposure during the first 6 months of life essentially increase your body mass, increase your weight to length score. So in other words, you weigh more than you should relative to your length. So, and there's actually, there's benefit too. There's a New England Journal of Medicine study this year showing in sub-Saharan Africa, it's a good thing for these kids to get antibiotics because they gain weight when in fact they need to gain weight. Okay, now, thus far, I think we've answered the question for most upper respiratory tract infection. Number one, the diagnosis is critical. And if the diagnosis is sloppy, the benefit of antibiotics is very slight to non-existent. We've also established that there is a downside to giving antibiotics, particularly when there's no upside. Now let me move into other things, other outpatient measures. So that is Dial soap. Looks like any Dial soap, but what you can't tell, this has got a little something extra in it. It's got quote-unquote antibacterials in it. And here is Palmolive antibacterial hand soap. So again, soap isn't good enough. You got a little something extra in there. And what's that little extra that's in there? It's something called triclosan. Many, many liquid and bar soaps contain an additional antibacterial agent, that is triclosan. What is the benefit and what is the risk? Well, anybody use this? Colgate Total, triclosan. Triclosan is in this. So not just soap, now we have toothpaste. Now, I'll tell you a little bit later, this one actually makes sense. If you happen to have gum disease, there may be some benefit here, but we don't realize sometimes that these things have it. Well, let me see. You think, oh, okay, soap, toothpaste. Well, how about socks? Actually, there are socks that contain triclosan. In fact, let me really give you a list of products containing triclosan. We talked about soap. We talked about dental, that Colgate Total has it, but cosmetics. Garden Botanica Powder Foundation, Mavala Lip Base, Paul Mitchell Detangler Combs, Bath and Body Works Antibacterial Moisturizing Lotions. How about deodorant? Arm and Hammer's Essentials Natural Deodorant and others. Oh, I'm not done. Kitchenware, Farberware's Microband Cutting Boards, Franklin Machine Products Ice Cream Scoops SZ20, clothes, the BioFresh socks that I just showed earlier, and undergarments with triclosan. How about office and school products? Ticonderoga pencils, so your children now can be protected with their pencils laced with triclosan. Binders, Bioneer Cool Mist humidifiers, Desigard antimicrobial earplugs, hockey helmets, paint, Blue Mountain wall coverings, escalator handrails, and yes, even your dogs are protected with Permate Labistro feeders and waterers, Infantino cart covers and baby carriers, and it goes on and on. But what does it offer? It's effective in the prevention of hospital-acquired infection. You know, you wash your hands, but it's not as effective as other things that we use, like alcohol-based preparations. It does work in people that you already know have recurrent periodontitis, but you have to have already had that for it to demonstrate benefits. So that's that Colgate Total I was talking about. But there are no data confirming extra health benefits from having an antibacterial-containing cleanser in homes. The AMA says, despite their recent proliferation in consumer products, the use of antimicrobial products such as triclosan in consumer products has not been studied extensively. No data support their efficacy when used in products or any need for them. It may be prudent to avoid the use of antimicrobial products in consumer products. Well, how about the resistance issue? There is no convincing evidence to support the contention that usage in all these products has resulted in the development of resistant bacteria. However, there are a number of examples of induced resistance where with a number of organisms where if you expose it in a laboratory setting, you can show that in fact it will not only, it will result in altered sensitivity to drugs that we really use, like penicillins, tetracyclines, and quinolones. And there are other effects from triclosan. Animal studies have shown interference with hormones critical for normal development and function of the brain and reproductive system. It's been associated with lower levels of thyroid hormone and testosterone. There's another agent called triclocarbon. It's been shown to artificially amplify the effects of sex hormones such as estrogen and testosterone. So again, this is one of those things where it doesn't seem to harm immediately, but boy, it tells me there's so much we don't know. And in the absence of data showing it actually does something good, I just think this is not a good thing for us to be using as much as we are. So what should we be using? Well, what about this? Zinc for the common cold. A lot of data out there. And in fact, it works. In fact, here's 17 trials reviewed with 2,000 participants. It looks like if you take zinc, that you can reduce cold symptoms by about a day and a half, approximately. Ironically, though, this has only been shown for adults and not children. Why? It tastes terrible. And kids are smarter when something goes in their mouth and it tastes terrible. They go, I am not putting that in my mouth anymore. So it doesn't work so well for kids, but seems to work well for adults. What about the whole probiotic thing? Well, you know what? They actually help. And in fact, there have been large studies that, and this one here, this meta-analysis, that show that if you take it with antibiotics, it prevents Clostridium difficile. Now, it's one of these issues, again, that you'd have to treat a lot of patients to, in fact, have a few that benefit. But there's little doubt that, in fact, and it's not just one probiotic, there are a number of them that tend to work to prevent this complication. And then I'm going to close with this. Vicks VapoRub. Does it work? It's been studied. They did a study of eligible children aged 2 to 11 years old with symptoms attributed to upper respiratory tract infections characterized by cough, congestion, and rhinorrhea that lasted 7 days or longer. 138 children were randomized to Vicks VapoRub or Petrolatum without the Vicks menthol or no intervention. And what they did for the parents would massage either the Vicks VapoRub or Petrolatum, or they did nothing, into the child's neck 30 minutes before bedtime. And what they did for the parents, they gave them a little tiny container of whatever their kid was getting. And so what they did was, in fact, they took this. They had to take it, and they had, if I could take it back, they gave all the parents Vicks VapoRub, and they had to put a little bit in their nose before they actually treated their kid, because obviously you can smell. You know when, in fact, you have Vicks versus when you have just Petrolatum. So what were the results? The results were the following. If you take this one, it's a bit of a confusing slide, but what you need to know is the first bar here in all of these figures represents Vicks VapoRub. The next one all the way through, this is Petrolatum. And the last one is nothing. This is like no intervention whatsoever. So then what do you see here? The key is comparing Vicks VapoRub to the Petrolatum, because frankly, just having a nice massage before you go to bed is not a bad thing, and maybe that would be a good thing for someone who feels terrible. So what you really want to know is, what is the benefit of Vicks versus the Petrolatum? And it turns out, the first one is, what was the impact on cough frequency? It's greater, but it's not significant. What is it on cough severity? It's, again, not significant. Third one, what about congestion? What about runny nose? There really wasn't a benefit. It's only when you get to these two here that you have a substantial significant effect. So what is that? This one here, if you got Vicks VapoRub versus Petrolatum, the child was significantly more likely to sleep through the night. And perhaps the most important outcome is the one next to it. This was the likelihood the parent would sleep through the night. So my conclusion is Vicks VapoRub works and, in fact, is reasonable. And if it spares you the use of antibiotics that should not have been used in the first place, why not? So with that, I think I'm right on time. That is my last slide. We have a few minutes for questions. Otherwise, thank you for your attention and have a good evening. Any questions from the audience? Yes. So the question is, are there any long-term consequences for long-term use of Vicks? You know, and to my knowledge, no, there is not. I mean, if you think about it, it's a little bit like traditional Chinese medicine. In other words, that's usually not done in a controlled way. And the argument on traditional Chinese medicine is, look, it's been used with millions of people. We know what works and what does not work. We know what the toxicities are. If you think about Vicks VapoRub, that has been used forever, and one would expect that if there was a long-term consequence, I think we would know it. It's not a very scientific answer, but I doubt very much that there's a long-term sequelae with chronic use of Vicks VapoRub. Excellent question. I'll repeat it so everybody else gets it, and for those that someday listen to this in the future. So the question was, in light of Medicare's mandate that they are planning to, in fact, not reimburse, for example, Clostridium difficile disease that happens in the hospital. And the question was, how do you know that, in fact, they got it in the hospital versus got it before they came to the hospital? And that is an excellent question. And that's why, if you remember, they started chewing on this in 2008. They haven't decided. It's because not only that, but why, even if, in fact, they got Clostridium difficile with appropriate use of antibiotics, how do you know? Because this organism is not only something that happens after you got antibiotics, it's also when you do sloppy infection control procedures. So, in fact, maybe it had nothing to do with antibiotics. It's that somebody did not wash their hands when they went from patient A to patient B. And that's the reason the liability piece is very, very difficult to nail down. But that's an excellent question. But the fact that it has been 6 years and they haven't called it yet tells you they're struggling. They're right in a way what they're trying to do, but the determine the guilt, shall I say, is very hard to do. Okay, well, thank you all. I hope you enjoyed it, and have a good evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.